Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us for our new 2020 season. And we really appreciate you guys for following all our social media accounts and doing everything that we say, like leaving those 5-star reviews on iTunes. So thank you guys. Please keep it up. Please tell your friends and let's get the museum built.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. If it's your first time, welcome to season two. That sounds kind of weird to say, but I guess it's season two. So if you haven't listened before, go back and listen to season one, too. You're going to like what you hear. I think you're going to like what you hear today. And after that, do like Phil said, go follow us on all the social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter. Do we have a Facebook page, Phil? I really don't know. I don't have
we
a do. Facebook.
Yeah, we have the Book of Faces.
We do have the Book of Faces, yeah. Too. That's how old and lame I am. I don't even look at the Facebooks, but we've got everything, or just look us up at theyhadtogooout.com, and you'll find us. Follow us. Give us a review. Hopefully it's 5 stars. Let's get that museum built, and let's have some fun today.
Perfect. Hey, and we got another bosun mate for everyone out there, which
we're
is, gonna
which
have is
fun
always
today.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, he went out, right?
Right.
Just like all BMs. So it should be an exciting show. Who we got on the line is Chief Bosun Mate Retired Russell Burris. He's from Sacramento, California. Went to boot camp with Recruit Company Hotel 87. That was back when they graduated out of Alameda. First unit was the Coast Guard Cutter Basswood out of Guam. Crazy story. He served under, get this, Bill, you ready? Master Chief Horsley.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, you should have saw the face, guys. It was. if you don't know who that is, just look it up. BMCM Horsley, and you'll figure it out real quick. Hopefully he tells us a couple stories. I got a few notes here.
The man has buildings named after him. I'll just tell you that.
Yep. Went to Station Monterey as a SNBM. Got certified on the 44 MLB, the 40-foot UTB. Then went to boating safety team in Stockton. Then took a major move to Station Belle Isle over near Detroit. He was on a 110 after that. Then Station San Francisco. Station Noyo River when it was co-located with the Point Ledge, so he served on kind of both at the same time. Then to a deployable law enforcement unit out of Los Angeles, Long Beach, to the Rescue Coordination Center out of Long Beach, made chief, they sent him to the Mighty Monroe, and then rounded out his service after 26 years at MSO Alameda doing Marine license exams. Retired back in 1996. And with that, Russell, we welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome, Russell. And, yeah, welcome. So we're going to kick off the show the way we always do here in Season 2. And what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Okay. I would say priority number one would be Station Monterey. I had just made BM3 after getting qualified as a coxswain as an SNBM.
What platform were you on, Russell, down there?
The 44 and the 40-footer.
44 and the 40-footer. And just for anybody that doesn't know Monterey, I think you're at the south end of the bay, right?
Correct.
Yep. And then was it a surf unit back then, or was it still like just a multi-mission station?
Yes, it was a multi-mission. When I first got there, it was not even station. It was Group Monterey.
That's right, and they got to keep that footprint. Like, even to this day, I think it's still mostly, like, when it was the sector, right? So they have more buildings than everyone else.
Oh, really?
Yeah, even though it was just a station.
Yeah, it was a weird time to be there. When I got there, they were just getting ready to demolish the old station on Lighthouse Avenue, and they built a new station, which I never stayed in. The whole time I was there, we were getting off-station housing, BAQ, BAS, and the duty sections lived in a mobile home they parked down near the breakwater.
Nothing's changed. I mean, like, as far as
nothing says Coast Guard more than we're going to live in a mobile home.
Standard. Hey, when it the docks down there, did you guys have the same sea lion problem that they had when I was around there?
Oh, absolutely. We used to get underway every once in a while at the request of the merchants on Fisherman's Wharf there to hose off the rocks with a fire hose because the smell used to get so bad from all the excrement.
Right, I believe it.
Greenpeace is going to protest this episode now that you just said that.
Well, that was back in the 70s. Right, I mean, that was right. When you could put like the sprinkler on the dock, right, and just have it go. You can't do that anymore. Right. I don't think. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, we used the firefighting hose from the 44.
Yeah, I believe it, and it probably still didn't work that well.
Right.
You know. Yeah, those sea lions take some big excrements.
They're large animals.
Yeah.
All right, sorry, Russell. So you've set the stage for us. You're on the 44 in Monterey Bay. What happens?
My officer in charge was Tom Beecham at the time, and I was pressed into service to be get qualified as a coxswain because we had lost a couple of people due to transfers and attrition. So it was basically a crash course, literally, for about 4 weeks to get my boat handling skills.
I like how you framed it. You were pressed into service. It sounds like they just went to the local bar, grabbed you, and like and just made it happen.
It's jail or the Coast Guard.
I was already crew qualified, but you know, I hadn't expected to start my coxswain quals yet. But that being said, I graduated and got certified, and I'd been running the boats for a while, and then one night about 3 a.m., don't remember exactly the date, but I believe it was in 1976, we got an initial report of the fishing vessel Santa Rosalita, taking on water just west of Point Pinos, which is the southernmost west point of Monterey Bay. My crew and I got underway, and we were initially setting up the dewatering pumps. When we got to the last known position, we couldn't see the fishing vessel. So we immediately starting a search. About then, we got a radio call from the station saying the Pacific Grove Fire and Rescue Team located the boat. They had run aground at the point, and there was five crew members. Three were still on the vessel, but two were missing. so we started doing basically a parallel search to the shoreline using the searchlight. After, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, one of my crew members heard cries for help coming from inside the breakers, and we were able to locate with the searchlight two men together. At this time, I reported that to the station, and they informed me that a helicopter had been dispatched from Air Station San Francisco, but it would take about 45 minutes to arrive on scene. So they were too far from the beach to be assisted by the shore rescue teams, and I maneuvered the 44 to a point to where we were able to toss a life ring with a line attached to the closest crew member. He managed to grab it, and as we pulled him, as my crew pulled him toward the well deck, he was so cold and hypothermic, they had no life jackets, they had no kind of any exposure gear whatsoever back in those days. He couldn't assist them getting aboard. I actually had to get out of the helmsman's chair and grab the guy by the seat of his pants to help my other two crew members haul him aboard.
I can picture that too. I know exactly, like, you know, when the two crewmen, they've got an arm each, right? Or like they're hooked under his arms,
yeah.
And then they're just sitting there struggling to get it, to get right. That last, you know, get over the hump, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My two crew members, by the way, I'd like to mention them, Seaman Mark Ace and MK3 Mike Boggs. They did a hell of a job, and we had always worked together as a crew. Mark was actually my roommate at the time. Anyway, I tried to maneuver again to recover the second man. We got close enough for him to grab the life ring, but at this time, he was just unable to hold on to it. We made a couple of attempts, and he just couldn't get it. And right at that moment, we were dangerously close to the shoreline, and I made the decision to take the boat in amongst the breakers to get as close as possible. And at that moment, a wave picked up our stern, and when we came down, we hit some rocks. I lost both of my engines and the steering.
What did that sound like, Russell?
Oh, it was just a big thump, like you would expect.
Right.
It was all rocks. There was no sand whatsoever on this point. I lost sight of the gentleman, but I remember the last thing I saw. I was close enough to see his eyes. And the panic look in his face. And unfortunately, he didn't make it. His body was later recovered. Meanwhile, my crew and I, we battened down the hatches. We still had the one fisherman aboard. And we ended up high and dry on the beach. As the tide went out, we were sitting perfectly upright on like three rocks. The hull suffered no punctures, just some dents, but the propellers were actually bent up into the rudders.
That'll take her out of commission pretty quick, I'd say.
Yeah. So So we were able to get off the boat with the assistance of the Pacific Grove Fire and Rescue Department. And naturally, this being a big deal, the area where we were was an environmentally protected area.
What's Monterey? And it's Monterey Bay, Russell. Right. I think, yeah, from the limit out on out, right?
Yeah. So the Coast Guard had to get special permission in concert with the Army Corps of Engineers. They actually had to bulldoze a road down to where the boat was, bring a flatbed trailer down there. Our DCs at the group made a makeshift cradle, and they brought a crane down and lifted the 44346 off the beach, trucked it back to the station, and it was subsequently later towed up to San Francisco for repair by the Cape Wash that was also stationed in Monterey at the time.
If you're going to go big, go big. I don't know. I'm still trying to process all everything they had to do to get that out of there.
I just want to know, was the scariest part of the whole thing?
It was a major, and it was a local media circus.
I'm sure.
But my biggest fear was I got told the district commander was flying down.
Yeah, that would suck. I could imagine. I know the reason that you took it in there, right? But that would suck hearing that.
The radio call to the OIC to tell them, hey, your boat's sitting on some rocks, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I fully understood what I thought at the time was the best option to get both of those men. They would have both drowned had I not gone into the surf line, and so I didn't really know what the outcome for me would be, but that was okay. So the Admiral flew down. It was actually the next day, and he talked to me and he said, did you save someone? And I said, yes, Admiral, I did. He looked at me for a second, and then he just said, don't worry about it. We got more boats.
Solid.
That's awesome.
Solid.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, man, that's a heck of a story right there.
Yeah.
I'm imagining what you must have been feeling that whole time, right? Like, I mean, you knew you made the right call to try and do everything you could to save him, and then to know the fallout was coming at the back on the backside.
But. Yeah, and to this day, that I will tell you later, that triggered a PTSD episode for me later on in my career. But yeah, I still remember Andrew Machi, 4 years old. He was the one that didn't survive. I still remember his name.
Yeah, and I could tell it affected you just when you said you could see his eyes, because I'm fully with you. I think once you've made eye contact with somebody and then they don't make it, it definitely comes back to revisit you later in life.
Yes, it does.
Yep.
And it did.
Yeah, well, I think Russell, if nothing else, if the rest of the audience doesn't understand, I think the two people you're talking to now, understand the gravity of you taking that boat in there. That's... And I think I would appreciate it if it was me or my family or friends or anybody else that was about to die, the risks you took. So,
yeah.
Bravo, Zulu.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you made it. I'm glad you made it out of that, man. And you got to complete your career too, right?
The other thing, I'm sitting here thinking about, like, how many boats today, if you slammed them down on the rocks like that, do you think wouldn't have a hole in the bottom?
Oh, well, like
the F-44 was just a tank.
Let's talk about what might happen to the 29.
Right.
It might have just rattled apart, and right. You'd be swimming in it.
I mean, do you even think the 47 would probably get a hole punched in it, too?
Yeah, but the 47 would. It'd make it. You know
right.
what I mean? Like,
right.
The engines would probably still turn. Like, even with the thing in the right. in the rudder, like, it would still go.
Yeah, and the other thing I based my decision on was I considered myself a pretty good swimmer, and I was a certified scuba diver and stuff. I knew for a fact I was the best swimmer amongst my crew, and it was, do I jump in the water to go after this guy and leave the boat in the hands of either my engineer or my crew member, or not? And it was damn close that I didn't jump overboard.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, you're making this decision at night with people actively dying. I
right.
mean, it's not, yeah. you know, I mean, the benefit of being able to look back at it, you could have made all kinds of different decisions. But
you can Monday morning quarterback yeah, all day, but.
You were there, you made the call that you had to make. I mean, staying with the boat's usually the best call, I would say.
Yeah.
And it may have still been, right? I mean, you don't know right. what would have happened if, right. if you would have done it.
No, yeah. I don't. You know, he might, you know, I don't know if I could have, you know, got him back to the boat or not. And then with both of us in the water, if my crew could have got us back into the boat.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's crazy to think, like, the, you know, the Hilo gives you the 40-minute response time, which is, I mean, Monterey's a pretty far haul from San Fran.
Right.
You know, right, 40 yeah. minutes, he wouldn't have been there. It was over by at that point. It was you guys
yeah.
taking action or bust.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. No, Russell, what an impactful story. Hey,
yeah.
I would ask you, I know you said it triggered a PTSD incident later. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that and kind of how you overcame it?
Yeah.
If you're willing to, man, it's all right if you're not. Just a question.
I can do it maybe on a later date or something.
Sure.
Because, it's still something that I'm dealing with, you know, and it ultimately almost got me kicked out of the Coast Guard,
yeah.
but it didn't.
Yeah.
Well, I hear you, man. If you ever need to talk about it or whatever, Bill and I are available on and off the air.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't need to be something that's on the air, for sure.
For sure. And the only reason I asked was just because there's a lot of people that struggle out there, so it's always good to get another perspective. And if you ever feel like talking about it again later, let us know, man,
yep.
on or off.
Sure. No, I'd be willing to talk about it online because, yeah, I if it could help others, absolutely. So, you know, I'm not ashamed of it. It's just part of me now, just like everything else.
Yeah, man, all human, right? You got to own it. Like, if you own it, usually, it, you know, you can start working to correct it.
Yeah, and I think that's something we're getting better as a service talking about, like realizing we do stuff that it's hard on you. It's hard on your minds, and it's mm-hmm. good to recognize it and hopefully be able to get help for it and maybe be able to help our shipmates in the process of taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much off topic, but yeah, it was like I was going to try to get the record of that case from the Freedom of Information Act so I could submit, you know, a claim with the VA because the VA seems to have a problem with Coast Guard people as far as, well, what battle were you in? And you can't really cite a particular battle.
Yeah, totally different job
right.
and mission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how old were you when this went down?
Let's see, in 1975, 20 years old.
Yeah, I mean, you know, young men out there making life and death decisions. And it's not like you were a spectator either. It was you were in command of the boat and everybody there. It was, you were the one that had to make the call. So, I mean, that's, I know how impactful it is. I mean, a lot of people do.
Yeah, I think hopefully people are getting better at recognizing that it doesn't matter what the kind of what the cause was. When you've seen something that traumatic, it's going to affect your brain regardless. And it's because of your service. So hopefully you can get what you deserve.
Yeah.
And it's so random, too. You know what I mean? Like, one night you're standing duty, and then you're just standing duty, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, lives are at risk, right?
Yeah.
And you're making decisions. It's crazy how it happens. I love the Coast Guard for it, you know?
Can't plan for it.
Nope.
Which is good. I'm bad at planning.
I'd do the whole thing over again in a heartbeat. No questions, no doubts, no hesitation.
Yeah. Well, Russell, let's. So I got a few questions for you, right? I mean, you've been at pretty varied units. But when you and I were talking on the phone when we were setting this up, we talked about your time in Guam. Can you talk to us about your time under Master Chief Horsley? And then I know you saw at least two pretty crazy things in Guam that kind of blew my mind when we talked about it. So can you talk about those?
Sure.
Awesome.
Sure. Like I said, when I graduated boot camp, I picked 40th in my company. So I was not the honor graduate, far from it. There wasn't really a lot of A schools available, and I didn't know if I wanted to go to a cutter or not. In fact, when I walked through the gates of Alameda, I didn't even know the Coast Guard had ships. I'd only seen the small boats.
That hasn't changed.
Yeah, that hasn't changed at all.
Kids are like, wait, I have to go on a ship?
Yeah, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So, the luck of the draw, I took Hawaii for further assignment, which was kind of a vague thing.
You're like the second guy that's had that thing. Hawaii for further assignment. It sounds so good, right?
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was a thing. And I was in Hawaii for about a week and a half, and luckily, I got paid while I was there, so I got to spend a little time. A couple guys and I rented a dune buggy, and we kind of cruised around the island and stuff. So had a good time. I was 17 back then at the time. They said, well, you're going to Guam. And I had never heard of that island at all. No. They took me to the operations center and showed me a map of this little dot thousands of miles away from Hawaii. And for those that don't know, Guam is 32 miles long and about 6.5 miles wide at the widest. It's not a big place. And it was only later I discovered all the history, not only the Coast Guard had there, World War II and stuff, but, you know, everything. So I fly to Hawaii, from Hawaii to Guam, go to the Mariana section office. It was called MARSEC at the time, and with two other recruits. And a lieutenant said, we got three billets available. One is a Loran station in Japan. The other is the buoy depot here on Guam. And the third is the Basswood, a buoy tender. Of course, all three of us said, Loran station, Japan. So we couldn't come to a decision. So the lieutenant did what lieutenants do. He put our names in a hat, and we picked our units out of the hat.
I thought you were going to say he made the chief decide.
I thought it was going to be Roshi and Bo, man. I thought like just rock, paper, scissors.
Nope. I got the Basswood out of the hat. at the time, I didn't know I absolutely got the best choice out of the three.
Yeah, I'd say you won. Was that the Loran station in Japan? Was it actually in Japan, or was it like an island in the middle of nowhere?
I don't even know. I don't.
Okay, because we...
What was the name of that one?
I can't remember. I was going to say, we had somebody else on the show who did a Loran station that was... It was, like, technically Japan, because Tokyo was the closest city, but it was actually, like, a coral atoll in the middle of nowhere with, like, a bunker and some seabirds.
It was around the same time frame. What if the other two... Say, yeah, that'd be crazy.
You don't remember the name of the other two non-rates there, do you?
No. Well, actually... One guy I knew, and we became kind of friends. He got the buoy depot, right. And so I saw him a while. I never saw the other guy again. But
it's because he went to a Loran station out in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, you definitely got the best deal out of that.
Yeah, and. Interesting side note, Master Chief Horsley had actually been an officer in charge of Loran Station Gishashi in Japan. And his wife was Japanese.
Oh, okay. Yeah, look at what we learned.
I learned so much on this show. I learned more Coast Guard history on this show than I do. And like,
it's crazy. Yeah. I read like many, many books and right. would never learn all of this.
Yeah, so I report to the basswood, and I'm so green I don't know anything. In fact, the first time I heard over the 1MC, now basswood arriving or basswood departing, I thought we were going somewhere.
Boot camp, so preparing people the same way all the way since then. Yep.
Yeah, but yeah, walking onto that buoy deck for the first time, Master Chief Horsley is exactly what you picture if you ever look at a cartoon of a chief bosun's mate. He was short, had a nose that looks like it'd been in 100 bar fights, tattoos. Everywhere, cigar, gravelly voice. You would, the guy in khakis, of course. You don't mess with him whatsoever. It was. I was in awe of the man. I mean, just from the get-go.
I love it.
Yeah,
I believe it.
I'm like imagining like a World War II movie, like the crusty old chief telling the CO how to actually do his job.
If you look at all the photos of Horsley now, they're all like, there's only like three of them, right? But they're all in his dress uniform, and he looks kind of rough in his dress uniform. Like you could imagine him on the buoy deck. Yeah.
Oh, he lived in his khakis, and he loved his khakis. In fact, one time he was a little upset because he said his wife was going to be mad at him because he lost his only set of civvies.
That's awesome.
Anyway, he had hold fast tattooed to his knuckles. He had the every old school tattoo you can think of, the spider webs on the elbows, the just.
Did he have the monkey bending over that says Aloha?
Everything. Yeah. He was exactly what you would expect. One time, he took me up to the Chiefs Club at the Navy base there, where we tied up. The Navy base was pretty large, and we had nuclear subs stationed there because this was still the Vietnam War going on and stuff, so there was a lot of naval ships in the harbor there, and we had our one little place where the buoy depot was, but Master Chief took me up to the chief's mess there. And I'm, of course, never been in a chief's mess or any kind of, you know, club like that. And we walk in. He goes up to the bar, and he stands in this spot. There's no bar stool. He would never, ever sit in a bar stool. He would just lean forward with his arms on the bar with that cigar. And I look over there, and I swear there is a brass plate embedded in the bar that says, "This spot belongs to Master Chief Donald Horsley, USCG."
There, awesome. There you go, man. That's pretty telling in itself, right?
He outranked all the Navy chiefs. He was like, everybody knew him. I mean, it was just incredible.
That's cool. That's cool to hear, like, hear the history of that man.
I was thinking you were going to tell me he didn't sit down because he was waiting to get in a bar fight and he didn't want to get pulled off his stool or something like crazy. Like, wouldn't stay with his back to the door.
Nah, he. I never saw him sit on a stool, ever. Yeah, but, a couple anecdotes. You know, I remember one night I was on the helm, and we had this old Filipino cook, Rocky. He'd been in for a long time as well. And he came up to the bridge because Master Chief Horsley had the officer of the deck. And he goes, "Hey, Chief, how you like the chow tonight?" And Master Chief just looked at him, took a drag on his cigars, and went, "God damn it, Rocky, that chow is just like my mother used to make when she was drunk."
That's good.
So he did have a sense of humor. He did. He was actually a pretty funny guy. But, yeah, it was rare when that came out. He also threw a fourth-class shackle at our XO when he keel-hauled a buoy when we were trying to work it.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and like I said, my BM1 at the time was Jerry Steed. He later became the lead instructor at the Motor Lifeboat School in Owako. And I recently found out he's my neighbor.
Oh, yeah, man. It's small world, right?
Yeah. Not only that, Tom Beecham, my officer in charge at Monterey, he lives across the river from me in Astoria. He got out of the Coast Guard and worked for the Army Corps of Engineers and retired from that.
Very cool. Yeah, it
sounds like you got a good neighborhood.
Right? Yeah, you got a neighborhood full of heroes over there.
Yeah, like I said, the mayor of Astoria is actually a retired Coast Guard captain.
And the officers, you know, not, no, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Yeah.
But we all laugh. Politics. We all laugh because we know.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Yeah. Another little anecdote, the month I got on Guam, it was December of 72. That November, the month before, they had captured the last Japanese soldier hiding out in the jungle on Guam.
Unreal. Unreal.
Yeah.
And then
so Guam was a pretty weird place, but like I said, I really love the duty. I got to work on a deck. I got qualified to run the boom, run the motor cargo boats, which was my first real coxswaining job. We all learned to scuba dive, and actually, our CO at the time, John Atrano, he submitted a proposal to headquarters to have divers stationed on buoy tenders, because we did a thing, myself and a Lieutenant Tsujimoto, we were able to change out a buoy chain without picking the buoy out of the water, cutting it off at the bridle and dropping it to the sinker and attaching a new chain and dropping it down and shackling it back in. And shortly after that, all the 14th District buoy tenders had permanent diver's billets.
Very cool. That's pretty rare that, like, you get to be a part of that kind of change.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool thing. Yeah.
And now I know, it's a rate.
Right, and yeah. I know that's still a billet for them out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they offered to send me to Navy Diving School to get the certification. I turned it down in favor of going to Station Monterey.
Smart man. So, yeah. Smart man. And he became a bosun mate, so right. It all worked out.
Oh, that was the proudest day of my life. It was when Master Chief Horsley called me into the chief's mess, and he gave me my striker patch.
Nice.
That's cool.
That's very cool. Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't, I was like, I was never more proud of anything until I actually made chief.
Did Horsley have any words of wisdom when he handed you your striker patch?
Pretty much, but I can't really say it. It's pretty, expletive loaded.
Yeah. That's what we were hoping for.
That's what we're going for.
Well, he says, don't fuck it up.
There we go. I knew it would be something like that. Yep. Good. Well, Russell, you told me on the phone we were talking about a B-52 incident out in Guam.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty crazy that you guys got involved even in the Vietnam conflict being where you were.
Yeah. On Guam, there's also Anderson Air Force Base, which was the home of B-52s that were doing daily flights over Vietnam in support of the war. And we got a call one time that a B-52 was returning to Anderson, and on approach, it, for some reason, exploded in midair. We were tasked with wreckage recovery, and this was my first real search and rescue case I was involved in. And we went out and we located pieces of wreckage floating, and we unfortunately found human remains and body parts, and incredibly one crew member that was badly burned, but he was still alive, and we recovered him. I never found out if he made it, or what the actual cause of the accident was, but that was my big welcome to the Coast Guard moment.
Yeah, what a moment, yeah, man. And what a lucky crewman on that B-52. I mean, we don't know the outcome, but like, right. To even be recovered out there in the Pacific, wow.
Yeah, it was just a couple of miles from Guam, so I mean we didn't have to travel very far.
Yeah,
that was, yeah, it was just an amazing thing. And then I would say about half a year, maybe 8 months later, we got another call. There was a towing vessel that was towing a decommissioned passenger ship, like a cruise ship, that was being towed to Taiwan for scrap, and we were experiencing that typhoon, and their tow line parted, and the ship grounded at the entrance of Apra Harbor, which is the naval base there, and the Navy was freaking out because the harbor entrance was blockaded, basically. And the wreck had broken in half. Part of it sank, and the other half was at the end of the breakwater. So we had to get underway during a full typhoon in a 180 to try to get a marker buoy on the wreck. And we were on the buoy deck laying out chains and some kind of makeshift grapnel to try to snag the wreck so we could mark it with a buoy so the Navy can send demolition teams down to blow it up and free up the harbor entrance again. I nearly got washed over the side because we had the buoy ports open, and I was lucky because I had my back to a wave, and we had on like full the old Navy Kapok jackets on, but yeah, I damn near went over the side.
I can't imagine trying to work a buoy in a typhoon. It's hard enough in like 5 or 6 footers. It gets kind of dicey. I can't imagine doing it in seas like that.
Yeah, but then, you know, you think about the strategic importance of the port. Oh, right? Yeah. With like, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's one of those things.
It's a big deal.
It doesn't shut down. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Right. And again, of course, yeah, the Coast Guard had to come save the Navy.
They could not wait. I mean, it was like if the Soviets at the time would have found out our subs couldn't get out of Guam and they were landlocked, basically. Yeah, it you never know what might have occurred, so... Yeah, it was definitely high priority, no nonsense, you gotta go.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. Yeah. That emergency ATON.
Right. See, it's a
first thing. Incident ever of emergency ATON that I've heard. That's exciting. I love it.
I'm definitely excited.
I know you are. Look at you. Well, Russell, you know, while we got you on the line, you've been stationed quite a few places. What was Belle Isle like in the, I'm guessing, late 70s, early 80s?
Oh, Belle Isle was...
Sounds like it was the same.
it was a little culture shock for me, you know, because I was from California, and I've heard, you know, this was back when they were, you know, after the Detroit riots and everything, and, you know, the Edmund Fitzgerald had just gone down a year previously. It was a crazy place. So I didn't really know, you know, what I was going to do there. Belle Isle was a pretty active station. Belle Isle is basically a city park that has a causeway bridge to downtown Detroit. And we're across the river from Windsor, Ontario, and we were right across from the Canadian Club Distillery, which was kind of nice because you could smell them brewing liquor all night long. And during Prohibition,
you're a true bosun mate that you said it smells kind of nice, because I've heard people go up there before and they're like, God, that liquor place just smells terrible, right? No, any bosun mate that goes up there is like, what a smell.
Canadian Club.
Yep, Canadian Club. I'm good.
Well, the funny part is back in Prohibition, when the Detroit River used to freeze over, people would drive from Detroit over to Windsor to get liquor and bring it back to Detroit.
Yeah,
it's probably why the distillery is there.
Now it's like cocaine and MDMA, I think. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that was kind of a weird thing, but we averaged between 800 and 1,000 SAR cases just in the summer.
Yeah.
Mostly, you know, just small routine tows and people run out of gas and things like that. But I can claim to being one of I don't know how many coxswains that have ever had a H-52 helicopter in tow.
Nice. Now, this is a story.
That's a low number, I'm sure.
How did this go down?
Air Station Detroit. We operated with them a lot. You know, we would do the standard hoisting drills and things like that. They were on a routine flight to the southern end of or the western end of Lake Erie, at where the Detroit River and empties into Lake Erie, and they suffered a mechanical failure and had to make an emergency water landing. Thankfully, those helicopters do have the boat haul and flotation. So I was tasked to take a 41 footer down to the Detroit River, take the helicopter in tow and bring it up the Detroit River to the group base Detroit, where they had a crane available to lift it out of the water and get it repaired. But
when you got the call, were you like, yes?
Well, I had made a motto and a little T-shirt that had us towing a helicopter, and I said, "Station Belle Isle, you blow it, we tow it."
Nice, I love it.
Nice. Are there any pictures of that? I'd love to see.
Yeah.
I wish I did. Unfortunately, yeah, but I don't have any pictures of that. I didn't really take a lot of pictures. Well, at the time,
nobody did in those days. It was a lot higher bar for pictures than it is now.
Film
all your toes and stuff. But I did get a good look from a bridge operator, because I had to go under a lift bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never seen a boat towing a helicopter before.
Did you pulled the crew off, right, before you threw them in tow?
No, they actually stayed on the helicopter.
Oh, they did? Nice. Yeah, wow. Huh. Yeah, that's commitment right there.
Yeah,
I don't know. I was just curious.
I never talked to them either.
Oh, you didn't? You got up, tossed the line, and went, huh?
Well, the helicopters, they already had, like, a towing bridle hooked up to the nose of the helicopter. So all we had to do was basically take a boat hook up to the bridle and snap into it. So we didn't have – they wouldn't have been able to get out on the front of the helicopter to assist us anyway.
Yeah.
So
they're probably in no mood to talk at that point either.
That's true.
No, I'm sure at least the flight mechanic wouldn't.
What, I mean, they didn't even have rescue swimmers then, right? Or –
No,
it was still flight mechs and just the pilots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
I'm just picturing this bridge operator like, what in God's name's going on, right?
Anytime we get to save the flyboys, it makes me happy.
Oh, for sure. That's why I say, like, you know, as soon as you get that call, like, yes, finally, right? They're not going to beat me to this one.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, And like I said, we had a lot of calls, but unfortunately, one of the other duties we used to have at Detroit was we would recover a lot of bodies.
Yeah.
We would get people that would fall through the ice, and we would find them months later. when the water warmed up, so they had been down for a while, and it was never nice.
No.
One time, I got a call to recover a body. It was just a torso, no arms, no legs, no head, and well, actually, it was just a torso and legs and a pair of pants. And I swear, at the time, I thought, "Oh my God, this is Jimmy Hoffa," because that happened not that recently before that. So.
Yeah, hey, man, I got to tell this one. So I remember in San Fran one time a suitcase, right? And somebody, I don't remember if it was the smell they reported or the look or whatever, but, like, we get there and we pop it open, and it was the same thing. It's like a torso, but the extremities, right, were, like, shoved in the bag with it.
There was foul play involved.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously, like, and I kind of remember the outcome to it, but, you know, there's a whole mob hit or something, but...
it might
it's crazy.
Been Jimmy Hoffa,
right? He could have been Jimmy Hoffa. It was female, but you know, whatever. Right. Unreal. Those are some of the worst, I think.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't have been so bad, but it was basically like a pair of pants with legs and a rib cage.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I don't even know how this was even floating, to be honest.
Yeah.
And of course, we tried to give it to the Canadians.
Smooth move.
And they said, "No, that's all right. You got it." And when we get back to the station, yes, barbecued ribs for lunch.
Oh, yeah, right? Oh, always, gosh, man, yeah. Always. Or like,
I think I'll have a salad today.
Chicken, dude. You know, like when skin, human flesh has been in the water for a long time, it starts. It's like jerk chicken,
yes,
almost, right? Yeah. So yeah. It's like inevitably you get back. Oh, we're having chicken for lunch. Great.
It's a Coast Guard meal. There's a 90% chance it's going to be chicken.
You're right. Yep. Crazy.
Well, like I said, we used to get so many, and a lot of them. That's how we basically knew it was springtime in Detroit, because we'd get three or four or five calls to recover bodies a week. They would just be popping up. Just
yeah, and that's rough when they've been in the water that long. It's not a...
Yeah. Of course, you have to tell the new guys, when you recover your first one, you got to stick your tongue in its ear.
Oh, my God. Only...
we all sit here.
We should add him on for the Halloween episode.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Please, no one do that.
Yeah, no, that's
nobody actually did it.
Oh, that's old guard.
But we told them
don't do that.
Well, you know, people got close though.
Right.
Yeah. Somebody let it go right to the very edge. Right. Yeah.
Before the crew was like, "No, we were kidding." No.
Yeah. What are you doing, you sicko? You know, like, crazy. What about, did you guys have ice rescue there, Russell? Did you, you know, in the winter months, what'd you do for ice rescue?
Yeah, we had a little 14-foot aluminum skiff. We didn't have any really real training. We didn't have any Gumby suits. We didn't have no, you know, we had wetsuits. That's about it. The group also had an airboat available. I don't know where they got it. Our officer in charge at the time, I can't remember his name exactly, but he would operate it. The only thing I remember about him, other than he wasn't the best boss in the world, he actually owned a 70 Dodge Daytona with a big wing.
Oh, the old Super Bees or whatever they were? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where he got it.
Just trailered it into the station one day. Here you go. That's cool.
Yeah. Anyway, I have to mention a good buddy of mine who's passed away. that I met at Belle Isle, and this is his real name, BM1 Guy Boring.
BM1 Guy do?
Well, we became good friends. We used to hang out together. We would do quote unquote parts runs into town.
That's called a boondoggle.
You would every other non rate, right?
Yeah. I was a BM2 at the time, yeah. At Station Belle Isle. So he was a BM1. He was our operations petty officer. And he was a good guy. And the reason we got together was we actually went to the same, back to the Coast Guard Small World, we actually went to the same junior high school in Sacramento.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know him at the time. So I had never, met him. Later on, we both got stationed again at San Francisco, at Station San Francisco of YBI. So I served with him twice, and, I'm sorry he's gone, because you want sea stories. Guy Boring has them, including the time then Mayor Dianne Feinstein wanted to take a cruise out on the bay before the Fleet Week.
Was she the mayor of San Fran?
Yes.
Oh yeah, I didn't even know that history.
I
knew like Gavin Newsom.
I didn't know that either.
That was the last one. Yeah.
Oh, this is the story. Dianne Feinstein, at the time, was San Francisco supervisors, which is kind of like their city council. She was the head of that. And George Moscone was the mayor, and one of the other supervisors had a beef with him and shot him in his office. And that made Dianne Feinstein the mayor of San Francisco.
Hmm.
And her political career took off from there. So while she was mayor, we were at Station San Francisco, and Guy was detailed to take her out on a 41 for a tour of the waterfront, and he refused. And the group commander says, "Guy, what are you doing?" He says, "She's got on high heels, Commander. That's a safety hazard." Refused.
Because Dianne Feinstein had on heels. Yeah, I can see that going over well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the group commander just shook his head and told Guy, "Do I have to send you to charm school?"
That's good.
Yeah, he was a good guy. But I do have my second biggest rescue was at Station Belle Isle. I can definitely say that. It happened the Great Lakes during the summer. They get these sudden thunderstorms that blow up out of nowhere. And they're very severe, they're very strong, and sudden. One day I had the duty, and I could see these storm clouds coming up from the west. And I told my crew, "Uh-oh, start putting on your rain gear." And as we were doing that, the wind went from zero to almost 70 knots. It started raining. It was thunder and lightning. The visibility dropped to zero. And right about then, we got a call from one of the Great Lakes ore carriers that he had just passed a bunch of capsized sailboats upriver, and due to the conditions, he was unable to assist. So we got underway in the 41 footer, my crew and I, and our second boat crew got underway in the we still had a 40 footer, and we went to the scene. I had to go full throttle just to get out of the mooring basin. The wind was blowing that strong, and we got on scene, couldn't really see anything. All of a sudden we saw heads pop up, and my crew just started pulling people aboard, and we ended up with 10 people. One was deceased, 9 were still alive. We put them down in the cabin and got them blankets and stuff, and I had the second boat go across river to the Canadian side. There was another island there called Peach Island, and they had some there was some boats beached on there. Apparently there was a sailing class that was out doing, you know, out there. So we had no idea how many people were out, how many boats, anything. We spent the next 2 days looking for a couple people that were still reported missing. We never did find them. But that was kind of a slam bam. It just happens right now. Boom, boom, boom. Pick them up. We didn't have time to try to the young woman who didn't make it. We didn't have time to really try to resuscitate her, and that's another thing that still haunts me to this day. We don't know if we could have saved her or not. I don't know, but I don't know why, but that was the case where I got recommended for a Coast Guard Commendation Medal, but I eventually got a Coast Guard Achievement Medal with an O device for that.
Yeah, well deserved.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I was kind of upset about it, though, because the other boat crew and my crew, they got absolutely nothing. And I didn't think that was correct, but that was not my decision.
Right. Yeah, you're not alone in that.
I feel like that's the way it always goes.
Yeah, you really never know, right? Like, right. It's all, whoever's there and whatever is going to make the endorser look the best, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, Russell, I mean, that's, you know, it just speaks to the, it always, like, vexes me, right, about the ocean. I mean, one minute it's calm, the next minute it's a storm. Maybe one day everyone survives and it's no big deal and they just rode it out and had fun, and then the next day tons of people die, right? It's just, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, the ocean is the ocean. There's no rhyme or reason to her, I don't think.
Nope.
Yeah, and this was the Detroit River. So,
right, yeah,
you know,
I mean, yeah, the sea, right? I mean, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
It just went crazy.
Yeah.
And when you have a 1,000-foot ore freighter that's afraid to maneuver because of the weather, that's some pretty severe stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, crazy. I mean, well-deserved medal, and I think,
for sure.
I mean, obviously you guys did what you had to do. I think you know, if you got to hold back resuscitation efforts for one because she was recovered unresponsive, and then you go on to save 8 more immediately after, what can you really do?
Yeah, and that was it. You know, that was another decision I had to make at the time. You know, it's like, yeah, I got other people in the water. I only have 2 crew members. I can't break somebody off to try this, and I don't know, But it did. One thing that I did get from that was after that episode, that's when the Coast Guard started EMT school.
Yeah.
And I volunteered and was in the first EMT class at Training Center of Petaluma.
Which is very cool, Russell, because it shows you care, man. Like, after every one of these, you know, I think that's the way everybody should live up to
being.
Right?
I think it's who everybody wants to be, right?
Right. Like, I mean, you got to care about your job. I mean, this is your – it's not a job. It's a duty, right? Like, you signed up to do that. That's your duty. That's what you do. It's a part of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, unreal, man. Just thinking about it now.
Career. Like, just we've only heard a couple of highlights.
Like, I want to have you back on. I mean, we're sitting at about an hour seven. That's usually kind of our episode timeline.
I feel like we're just scratching the surface here.
I know, like, man. That was like your second.
Right.
You know, second cool case. Like, we want to have you back on, Russell, if you're willing.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be more than willing to do that, guys.
Awesome. Well, we might kill this episode and then bring you back on and spend some more time with you.
Yeah, sure.
Awesome.
I think there's more there. It sounds like there's a lot more there. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, dude, we didn't even get into Station San Fran, which I know is crazy.
Right.
Station Noyo. And then on the Cutter Monroe as a chief, that's got to be good.
Those are all port call stories, though.
Yeah, I know. Well, hey, Russell, we so appreciate your time today, and we appreciate your service to the country, and the decisions that you had to make. I think if anybody takes anything from this is, those are decisions that are being made by 20-something people out there, right? Like,
right.
I mean, you're 20-some years old, you're leading three or four people on a boat crew. You can't call back to anybody and make that decision. You don't have time.
You got to make the choice. You got to make it quick. And sometimes there's no good choice.
Right. You just got to live with it, right, and move on and know that you did the right thing at the right time because that's the decision you made.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. You can play it over 100,000 times in your head and go, what if I did this? What if I did this? But, you know. That's what you do. You have to just go with what you know right then and deal with the consequences, you know, and that's okay. I was proud that I was able to bring one man home, you know. I would have loved to bring them both, but...
But again, Russell speaks to your character, man, that, like, you know, after the woman that you couldn't save in the Detroit River, you go back out and you graduate EMT school. That's how you get better at making those decisions, right? Or that you can make even more informed decisions as you train, you war game that stuff in your mind and you get better at it.
Yeah, just learn from every scenario. You learn from it and you move on. And,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's at EMT school. One of our guest instructors was the legendary Dr. Nimroth, who was the big researcher in cold water drownings and the mammalian reflex. And he developed the techniques that, somebody that dies or drowns in cold water, you know, you could resuscitate them. Had I known that at the time, I may have made this different decisions, but didn't have the knowledge, you know, so.
Well, again, Russell, thank you for your story. I can't wait to have you back on and talk more of them. And we really appreciate your service and appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks very much, Russell.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.